Welcome. You're listening to Unsung Stories, Women at Columbia's Computer Music Center, a podcast series and one part of a three-pronged event on the history of composers of marginalized identities, including women composers of color who've worked in electronic and computer music at the CMC and formerly the CPEMC, the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center. I'm Bridget Cohen, and today I'm in conversation with Pril Smiley. Pril Smiley is an American composer and pioneer of electronic mixed media. In the 1960s and 70s, she worked at the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, the first institutionally funded studio of its kind in the US. She became one of four primary instructors in electronic music at the center and also served as director. From 1968 to 74, she worked as a consultant to the Lincoln Center Repertory Theater in New York City and was awarded an NEA grant and a Guggenheim Fellowship. She has created scores for a substantial number of theater works in addition to scores for film and dance. Pril, thank you for joining us today. Many of our listeners are at an early stage of career choice and development. So let me begin by asking, how did you enter into a career in electronic mixed media that was so unusual in its time?
Well, it's almost a complicated beginning because the field was so new that my career really would have started with a lot of what would have happened if, or if this or if that. So if I hadn't been a maverick all my life, if I hadn't maybe had a mother as a professional musician, She was concertmistress of the Hudson Valley Philharmonic Orchestra and an early innovator in that, the upgrade of that orchestra. So we had had, I had had in my whole childhood, music in the house, musicians around, and not classical music, but sort of an outrageous bunch of characters. So of course I loved that. I didn't have great grades in high school, so I wasn't gonna be able to go to a Smith College or anything like that. And the only place I wanted to go was Bennington. And because in those earlier years, not just of electronic music, but contemporary music scene, there was already a network established between Bennington faculty, Bennington musicians, New York musicians, New York composers, and to a minor degree, the Hudson Valley. So in Bennington, in its earlier years, even when it was only 15 years old, there was a summer composers conference at Bennington, which attracted actually mostly composers and instrumentalists to Bennington to play and do workshops and feed off of each other. So there was already a milieu where, in a way, experimental and trying out compositions on each other. And I'll return to this in a minute, but early on in 1952, it was at one of those summertime Bennington composer conferences that Vladimir Ussachevsky and Otto Luening went up there with their engineer, Peter Mose from Columbia, where they had been mostly doing electronic music in their living rooms. And for a short time in the insane asylum of Bloomingdale, which was on Broadway and around 114th Street. But basically they went from their living rooms to the performance space at Bennington and were just doing experiments, which the other musicians loved and entered into. There was live recording of voices and experimenting around, and that engendered a lot of interest, which then led to immediate compositions by Luening and Ussachevsky and their first Composers Forum performance in New York City within the following year. So it was only less than 10 years that I entered Bennington College with that kind of, I mean, not all those composers were there, but Henry Brandt was there as a composer who had done a lot of experimental music and kind of as a gut course. I just signed up with him immediately. I had known him from the Hudson Valley. And within 2 months, he had, there was no question, I was just going to be a composition major. And partly just because even in 2 months, the way he taught his classes was not just here's what you do when you're a composer, but try this and come back next week and see if you can compose a piece like Mount Anthony out there. So he was challenging a student and saying, do something for me, you know, like take something out of yourself and put it forward rather than me teaching you, well, harmony and counterpoint in order to compose. So that got my attention right away, as it did many students. And to just jump ahead to the whole environment there, the way the college music curriculum was set up, it was faculty and instrumentalists, student instrumentalists, all working together. There was a workshop every Tuesday afternoon and where a composer would take his or her, the latest 10 bars you wrote on a string quartet, and faculty would play that 10 bars and then have a critique along with students, just like, I lost interest after the eighth bar or whatever. So there was that kind of collaboration. I was so naive. I thought that's kind of how the music world worked out there. Well, it wasn't, but, thanks to Brandt, in the beginning of my sophomore year, and Bennington had a work term where you would try to go out and find a 3-month job or internship or something in the winter term, the college shut down. And I asked Henry Brandt, I want to do something interesting in music. Where should I go? And he said, well, contact Vladimir Usachevsky in the Electronic Music Center. He knows me a bit, and I did an experiment there or something. So I set up a date to go interview Vladimir Usachevsky. He was just curious to take me on as an intern. Again, the field was so new. He had no idea what an internship would involve. I mean, I don't think he pictured, well, how can this person, Prill Smiley, even help me? And I didn't have any idea how I could be of help to him. So he set up an interview. We had a few missed chances. And finally on New Year's Day of 1963, I was to meet him, he said, in front of the Dodge Building on the corner of 116th and Broadway. And that's where the Music Center studio, the main studio at that time, was in the basement. He said, just meet me in the front of the building. And it happened to be in the middle of a huge blizzard. There was not anybody on campus. So I walked up and found the front of the building. He said, I'll probably be the only one there. You'll recognize me. The campus was shut down. And here was this enormous Russian guy with a full length Russian fur coat that went all the way to the ground and his Russian hat. It was kind of awesome. So we went down to the studio, neither of us still certain what the interview was supposed to be about. But he kind of looked at me and I kind of looked at him and I said, you know, this desk here, is this one you work at a lot? He said, yeah, I end up here because the music department is upstairs. I end up working here a lot. And I said, sure seems like a mess. He said, yeah, I can't control it. And I said, let's sort the papers. Let's have one pile that's called pending and another that says fairly pending and another pile that says urgent pending. And he thought that was great. We sorted out the desk and we talked for another 40 minutes. I still didn't feel like it was an interview. And I finally said, well, where do we go from here? And he kind of looked at me like a surprise. And he said, well, when can you show up for work? And I said, tomorrow. And he said, that's good. I'll just meet you, you know, here. At which point then he took me to another bigger studio. And that's kind of a whole story in itself. But he immediately had me do a some splicing exercise with a magnetic tape with his sounds, hundreds of sounds of brass instruments with different pitches. And he had to go on a trip to California. So my introduction was by myself figuring out how to splice 500 brass instrument sounds and label them on reels. So anyway, that was my foot in the door. He quickly discovered that I could be adept with the technical equipment. And so I worked all through that next couple of months. And then he was starting in on a film or theater score for something. And it was so, so exciting to me. And it was so new. I mean, it was new for him to even have a quote technician. But I started coming down on weekends from college, often staying up half the night just to work. He started paying me $2 an hour or meals or something. And then I came down the rest of most of my college years, certainly during that work term and summers, and there wasn't even in the beginning classes offered. By the time I graduated from Bennington, there had just been classes being offered in the graduate composition department at Columbia. And in fact, there weren't undergraduate courses in electronic music offered, just graduate. And in fact, it was a required course for graduate composers to take 1 year of electronic music. And it was quickly clear that by the time I graduated, and I was just able to walk into a teaching job because, you know, now Shield slightly a year later, because there wasn't anybody other than the other senior composers that would have been able to teach anybody. And the students in these graduate courses, they had to obviously have hands-on instruction. So there you are in a studio. Equipment wasn't very complicated, but that's when I started just working with students. And it was a way, of course, for me to learn, because although they were given exercises, they had different interpretations of how to build sound or do sounds, and I could experiment through them. I mean, I could say, let's see what happens when we record these percussion sounds and turn them into something else. So it was a great time of, and I guess bringing on the collaboration venue that I were milieu that I had had at Bennington. So since it was these early years, there was quite a few international fellowships, international composers, actually more than there were American composers the first few years I was there. You know, Mario Devidovsky, Bülent Arel from Turkey, İlhan Mimaroglu from Turkey, quite a few. And we shared techniques, we listened to each other. So that certainly wasn't the case later.
What strikes me in this narrative you're telling of your kind of entering into a new career or stumbling into a new career is how Henry Brandt and Bennington served as a kind of bridge to Columbia and to the newly established Electronic Music Center there and to Ussachevsky. And you entered into a kind of entirely new craft and a new persona, that of the composer / sound technician / educator. And at the same time, you're entering into this world, which is at a kind of emergent stage of development as a woman. And so there's a kind of challenge on two levels, because on the one hand, you're entering into basically what is a new kind of professional persona and way of or mode of creative practice using new technologies. And at the same time, you're entering into it as a woman at a time when there were very few women who could establish careers and in composition and gain any kind of credibility and credit for what they were doing and career advancement.
So yes, that was true. And with Alice Shields following me a year later, I was the first woman doing electronic music at all, I think, in the Northeast. Pauline Oliveros was simultaneously the first woman on the Western Coast to be establishing her and herself as a composer and her studio connections. I wasn't actually even aware of at all of being the first woman. It literally wouldn't have been on my mindset. And I think largely, you're just making me think, I don't even know if I thought of this before, but there were so few of us. And so if I graduated and I came in, or I'd been Ussachevsky's technician, assistant or whatever, he didn't have a choice. I mean, there wasn't any male, there wasn't a male composer, there weren't any students yet. So that I didn't even have, like a lot of women feel like they're in competition with males came first or males this or that. There was zero of that. And if anything, it was because I was the only one, I got to form my persona probably more than most men would have, because I just was an entity on myself. I don't want to generalize, but many women have ways of interacting with men and other people that are just more personal. There's no competitive edge. And so I engaged easily with every single male composer in the studio. And I felt like I had immediate respect, even though I was a generation younger. That certainly wasn't the case for many other women in short order after. Certainly women who became students, they were in the DMA program. They were treated as equals, but there was a much less percentage of them. And so I think it just was, so much of it was just being a new medium, and all of us were experimenting. Even Usachevsky was often contacted, because we were the first and the biggest electronic music center. And I was in charge of the Library of Tapes, which had more international names of composers than Americans. Usachevsky would be contacted, one of them was Canada, we want to put together a program of electronic music. This is this new wonderful thing. And he would send them tapes, including a composition of mine. So even in my first 2 years there, I wasn't even 25 years old yet. I had my compositions being sent around where people wouldn't even know if I was male or female. In fact, sometimes I was male, because Pril is spelled P-R-I-L, and both in uppercase and lowercase, R looks like an H. So I was Phil in some programs. That's a whole separate story, like how I got reviews when I was Phil compared to how I got music reviews when I was Pril. A story for another time, and an interesting one. So the only thing that felt a little bit, and I was naive, I wouldn't have known this at the time, was, and you've probably heard this from Al Shields, was the aspect where working with Usachevsky as his, quote, technicians, we got short shrift in no uncertain terms. We were just his technicians. But a lot of composers, Stockhausen, all over the world, had technicians. Edgar Varèse had either Bulent, Arel, or Mario Devidovsky, who were not just showing him how to thread a tape recorder, but in no uncertain terms, in a sense, composing sections of music for him. And Alice Shields and I certainly did that for Usachevsky, especially with a couple of films that he was doing. And Alice and I traded off sections of a film we would do. And we were presenting Usachevsky with a finished 20-second section of music, and he just took it verbatim, so to speak, as part of his composition. And I didn't, at the time, and our title, I think I was still being paid $2.50 an hour, my title just on the books, and some of this is payroll reason and union reasons, I was clerk, and Alice was technician Roman numeral two. It didn't matter to me. Even in my conscious mind, I wasn't going to be able to ask for a pay raise. And most especially, even at that time when we were apprentices for Usachevsky doing his films, I had already started my career in writing music for theater. And even at the time when the last time I helped Usachevsky with a film, I was actually literally on the payroll at Lincoln Center, as a paid electronic music consultant for a huge number of productions in an 8-year period. So that was where my focus was. And I was very able to live on, it was a total of like $5,000 a year at that time. But I just, anything I was doing in the Electronic Music Center, I was only going to be able to teach that particular thing. I didn't want to get a master's or a PhD. You know, it's already in this very heady world. So I wasn't interested in a typical track that someone would take. Like all the doctoral students that later I was teaching, by definition, they're doctors. So they're going on to teach in many times notable universities or whatever. So what I was doing, especially entering in the theater music, was just instantly something that was way beyond anything I would be doing if I were just writing kind of a straight electronic composition, which I also did. But well, I'll tell you the story of the very first theater gig that I did, and this was total serendipity. It was June in 1966. I was only a year out of college, so I was 23 years old, and I was in the studio and knock on the door, and I didn't recognize him, but Joseph Papp comes in, and he was directing a lot of things in New York, but was really well known for his series of Shakespeare in the Park in the summers. So he came in, we introduced each other, and I kind of looked at him. He said, well, I have an appointment with Usachevsky. And I said, ooh, you know, he must have forgotten, because he just took off early this morning on a plane to California, and he looked kind of, oh. And he said, well, I was going to talk to him. I'm doing Macbeth this summer in the park, and it's being done entirely in Spanish. And so it's a little bit out of the box. And I thought, I was wondering if there was a possibility of electronic sounds being used in my production. And so I said, well, he's not here, but I can play you some of the, like a cross section of the kinds of sounds that Usachevsky has worked with for all kinds of film, theater productions. And so I played him a cross section of sounds, and he kept kind of shaking his head, and he said, oh, there's, I can see why they're musical, but they don't, something like that doesn't lend itself to what I'm thinking of. And I said, well, what's your concept of what you're working on? And he said, well, because the play is done entirely in Spanish and the program was in Spanish, he said, part of my concept is that I'm having the sound of the language of Spanish drive some of my concept of the play. And he said, it turns out, for instance, he said that it's quite a bit faster moving than most productions of Macbeth would be in English. And I said, give me an example. And he said, well, for instance, in the very beginning, there's the witches and there's thunder and lightning. And he said, when you hear the witches' sounds in Spanish, they're already much more, it's a more dramatic sounding language. They're clipped, they're angular, they just have a whole different flavor. And he said, oh, I said, you mean like I have to be working on a electronic piece that's based on percussion sounds. I was a percussion minor in college. And he said, sure. And so I played him some of my modified percussion sounds, and immediately showed interest. He said, yes, that's great. That's very spiky. That's very angular. And so that was it. Then that was, I don't even remember if I got paid. It didn't matter. I thought, you know, this was pretty heady stuff. So I invited my friends for front row seats in the park. And very shortly after that, and this was a connection through a composer named Stanley Silverman. And I don't think it's because he went to Shakespeare in the Park, but he had done a lot of theater, music for theater productions. And he had Lincoln Center had just been built 2 years before with the Vivian Beaumont Theater and Lincoln Center Repertory Theater. And he was already involved, really like a staff music person there. And he approached me pretty soon after that, like within a year of doing the stuff in the park, and asked me to be involved in various productions So this, because it followed so soon after working for Joseph Pass, Stanley kind of opened up a whole new world, and it was based on because of the music I was doing, but just like little side avenues that went from that. And it was just the whole world opening up to me, which even with a digital world now, just I don't think would, not on this level, be available to people now. But again, it was such a new world. And he had a summer place up in Tanglewood with a family connection. And he had been working a bit with Simon and Garfunkel. I met them up there. They got intrigued with what I was doing. I dated Paul Simon for a while. Paul invited me to sit in on like all their recording sessions, especially on the album Bridge Over Troubled Water. And on one of the songs, and Paul was developing these songs as the recording was, it wasn't like he had just written all these songs and plopping them on an album. So some were in the works. And again, like my collaborative spirit of Bennington, there was one particular song he was working on that he was stuck a little bit after about 20 seconds into it. And I said, can I fool around in the Electronic Music Center just to see if there's some threads of something I could do? And he said, sure. And I did. And I came back. It didn't turn out to be used. And in fact, he got permanently stuck in that song. He never did finish it. But it was obviously a whole different world to be, you know, in that world with him and to be exposed to those recording sessions. So, but meanwhile, back in Lincoln Center, one of the, again, one of the really early on, and this was a big deal production. It involved King Lear, and it was Lee J. Cobb, who had been best known for his role in Death of a Salesman. Then he'd gone out to Hollywood and worked in TV for quite a while. He had a major heart attack or heart condition and was feeling his mortality and was just dying to get back to real theater. So he connected with the Vivian Beaumont Theater and he said he had always wanted to do King Lear. This is very, very challenging kind of, you know, he wanted this to be like his almost like final performance. And it was an interesting challenge. I learned later that, and some of this, I made notes at the time that it was kind of known at King Lear as an unactable play. And at one point, Henry James wrote, it's a great and terrible poem. It's sublime and dramatic, and it's not a production that gains from being presented, which Lee J. Cobb was really, really into. And he actually immediately had trouble with the director. The director was Jerry Friedman, was trying to direct with it being a presentation, the last big stand of Lee J. Cobb. Lee J. Cobb, because it was an unactable play, he knew the only way this could be his major voice was to work from the inside out. And it didn't mesh with what the director was trying to do. They struggled through a few rehearsals. And I was called in to do what was going to be what I called glorified sound effects. So especially when there's a scene on the Heath, that's where King Lear gets to really rant and rave and be in a fury, never get over the traitors of his cruel daughters. And so I was supposed to do, you know, kind of, it's on the Heath, it's a dramatic time, thunder and lightning sounds. And the director imagined what you could imagine. We all know what thunder and lightning sounds like. And I came in with just a couple samples of my idea of thunder and lightning, which went in quite a bit more scary direction than, and Lee J. Cobb said, oh, I want to explore that. And he literally started coming up to the Electronic Music Center because this was a real turn on to him. And he immediately saw a way for him to act at his best from the inside out. So when he came to the Electronic Music Center, it was more than letting him push the button, play button on the tape recorder, but I would play a sound and he would say, and he helped actually orchestrate with me. He said, well, my lines start here and then I kind of grow in my anger or my fury and I get mad. I get, you know, I'm losing my head. And he said, start with sort of known thunder, like what we think, and then gradually turn it into threatening thunder or mad, a madman. And so I would start to do that and he could say more, more. So we, I mean, not only do we have a great time, but again, it was just a kind of collaboration that was second nature to me at Bennington when faculty and students all the time wrote, composed things together, played each other's compositions, certainly not in the New York world. So then he and I would go back to the next rehearsal and the director, he was not taking to this. He couldn't, I mean, Lee Jay Cobb was really excited and it showed in the way he was projecting his lines. And the director still was a little bit stuck in what his idea had been. And at a certain point, the director kind of laid down his fist and just said, those sounds are too wild for me and I don't want them. And Lee Jay Cobb and I tried a slightly reduced version and the director still didn't like it. And the director, you know, Lee Jay Cobb said, I don't want a reduced version of these sounds. You know, this is what's turning me on. And the director said, well, I'm not going to stand for it. And Lee Jay Cobb said, I'm going to quit if you don't, you know, if you don't accept what's turning me on. And the director said, I'm going to quit if you don't. Yeah, I'm going to quit if you don't. If you don't allow me to direct my own damn play, they worked it out. Maybe with a female as a harmonizer, I'm not sure. But
so taking a kind of zoomed out perspective, it seems as though at the CPMC, you played this vital role facilitating the technical operations and enhancing the community life and, you know, at being an extraordinary administrator, but also essentially collaborating or composing some of the works that were the film works that were, you know, presented as Usachevsky's, and then also being treated as invisible labor or being taken for granted, at least certainly in terms of your pay and you know, and your official professional designation and status. But at the same time, you were able to enter into the world of theater, which presented extraordinarily rewarding creative opportunities and possibilities for a sort of creative collaboration that was made possible through your intensive engagement with electronic sound production. And could provoke controversies of the kind that you were just describing. What are your thoughts about that? Am I understanding the kind of overall scenario correctly? And I'd love to hear about more productions that you collaborated on, more theater productions.
Yeah, it's you have it exactly right. And that was working with Lee Jay Cobb was just one of the first ones. And that was mostly, in that one, my basic collaboration was just him as a lead actor and the disgruntled director who was only present, you know, at rehearsals. And I didn't go to all, I mean, the actual music score for that production, it's not like there's music running throughout like some of the other productions I did. So in a way, my actual creative sort of thrust in that was mostly limited to thunder and lightning. I think there was a, you know, minor, as I called them, glorified sound effects. But I could always, any sound effect I did in that production or any other production, sort of my Prill Smiley thing was to take an actual, like start with real thunder and turn it gradually into something that was scary or grotesque or strange, or that doesn't sound like thunder anymore. Because I quickly discovered that, well, first and foremost, in a way, it inspired actors to do their lines differently. And for all I know, have different body language sometimes on the stage. And certainly, you know, as I later found out, really with later productions, would really affect the audience, like sometimes in a physiological way. So the next one around that same time, within a year, was doing another Macbeth. Michael Kahn was the director, and he was a way out creative thinker. And this was Stratford, Connecticut. I think that was called American Shakespeare Festival, but another big venue. And so he had a very specific concept, and I spent a good part of the day with him working on the concept. He said, first of all, I had my little my text of the Macbeth play. He said, first of all, I'm treating this like in the whole play, like Macbeth is sort of present in the whole play. And I'm treating it as if Macbeth's life is just a big headache for him. In fact, it's kind of a migraine. And wherever he appears in the play, he's struggling between sort of reality and madness and just otherworldly things, but demons. And so that kind of lends itself to electronic music. He wanted music almost throughout, and he wanted the actors to be very directly involved with the rehearsals and the sounds coming in, and one to feed off of the other. And when we were first talking about it, he said he read me, I just have to get this like literally out of the script. He said, you know, Shakespeare says it really well, but he said, I like these words. He said, wrathful skies, sheets of fire, bursts of horrid thunder, groans of roaring wind and rain. And he used his voice like that. And he said, you know, that's just the verbal launching pad. And your sounds are supposed to, you know, take off from those words. And like most things I did, I wasn't using the actual words, but I was taking a recognizable sound. Like it might be, this is out on the scene where he's on a heath. And he's saying, it's already, like, Macbeth has already gone mad. Just like use your imagination for what you can do with the sounds. And I did, and it was, and especially with the Macbeth sounds, I could just take any sound that was sort of appropriate for that scene and turn it into, you know, something else. And when I worked with the actors, and pretty soon into one of the scenes where, like, Macbeth was really starting to feel his headache, he said, okay, Michael Kahn said, okay, go back to the studio and make me a migraine headache sound. That's very easy in electronic music. So I came back with, and he said, actually, this sound has to run about 4 minutes under the text and what are the actors are doing. And so I was able to come up with a very subliminal sound, and with these wonderful speakers in the space, you could do this. You couldn't even do this in a small room like an electronic studio, but these huge voice of the theater speakers could put out a subliminal sound that kind of went in waves, but almost not consciously hearing it, but it could go on for 4 minutes. And it seemed extremely effective. In fact, so effective that after a second rehearsal, actors started complaining of headaches. So we had to cut back at least on the volume of the sound, or not have it quite so threatening. So I think mostly he, again, it was just doing the sort of ethereal sounds and bouncing back before something that's a nightmare, and you're trying to be relieved of a nightmare. And there's kind of a heavenly atmospheric something that you're relieving yourself, getting out of the nightmare part. And I was just digging up yesterday a comment, because this says it actually better than I could. There's too much in the forest to see the trees. A woman who was a friend of my mother's in Poughkeepsie, she was an older woman, professor at Vassar. She had taught the classics and Shakespeare for years and years and years. And she came to that Connecticut production and wrote me a long letter. And she said, what you did with the witches, it was like a splendidly new extension of their meaning and their role and their function. And I thought, yeah, they became different characters to her. And she said the opening music, she said it was so marvelous. It was a weird mixture of heavenly and demonic simultaneously. She said, just like Macbeth's mind was. So she hadn't experienced in theater where it would be really hard with instruments to have demonic and heavenly at the same time, running and entwining with each other. She was absolutely intrigued with that. And she said that sort of because of that, she said she had a physical reaction to much of the sound. And she said it was a particular kind of scenery. Done is too hard to explain, but it was massive scenery that closed and opened whenever Macbeth entered or exited. And I had a sound that went along when the big doors opened and shut. And she said that sound you had, and she wrote like thoing or boing, she couldn't write it out. And she said that was Macbeth going in and out of when he exited and entered. He wasn't just leaving or coming back on stage. He was entering or exiting his world of fantasy or nightmare or some of both. And it was the sound that took her there. And she literally said, I see that I've been teaching this play for years, but I see it I'm feeling it in a whole different light in terms of what the roles of each of these, especially Macbeth, what the roles of each of these mean. The other production, and this was the epitome of a collaborative effort, and this was out in Cleveland, a Cleveland playhouse, and it was a production. It was a playwright and a director. This is 1972. Cleveland Playhouse is an enormous theater with huge numbers of speakers. He was writing, his play was called The Short Magical Ministry of the Reverend Dr. John Faust. And he would have described it as Faust's relationship with Satan. And his script really started pretty close to Satan. And he had certain very set concepts that this was going to take place, Faust's journey here, very tight time frame, on Easter Eve, and it was just going to go from 12 to 12. And I started with sounds of actually Big Ben in England ringing 12, but it started with maybe 1.5 sounds of an actual clock ringing 12, and it immediately went into broken up clock sound very gradually into something that by the time it was the ninth bong of the clock, it didn't sound remotely like a bong of a clock. And it went into ragged sounds that were already threatening, because that's where Faust's head was. Notably, even in the program, he billed this as a concept that was developed in rehearsal. He hadn't finished the play and he didn't want to, that the concept was developed in rehearsal with a company and music by Phil Smiley. So he really had the three, he had it as three equals. He's the playwright and director. I spent a lot of time in Cleveland, 3 days at a time. Often he and I would work through the night, you know, back and forth between, like he would write another four paragraphs and I would talk about sound. We'd go to rehearsal. I would play the last sounds I came up with. And where I had recorded, for instance, actors' voices, where they were kind of, it was a very occult kind of take on the whole subject. And so there's a lot of ceremonial things and actors doing strange things in groups and chanting. And so I had recorded actors' voices. And again, just in electronically starting with the actors' real voices, just I'd ask them, I'd record them and just ask them, you know, make sounds, you know, some words, be sure to put lots of silences in. So they're just snippets of your voices. And then I would take them back and electronically modify them. So they start as snippets of their voices, short snippets of sound, real voices, but again, just turning into something like, you know, this is definitely going toward the occult. And so I take those back to a rehearsal and the actress is like, can we have more of that? We want more of that, more of our voices. Make it go more higher, more lower. And again, the playwright would say, okay, I think I'll add a couple more paragraphs, you know, to this, this point in my script. So it was, I mean, the epitome of collaboration on that one. That was the most collaborative because it really was three equals between playwright, director, actors, and composer. And it just, it was certainly the most satisfying production I was part of. And, you know, going back to something you asked way long ago, there certainly wasn't 1 ounce for any of those actually of, well, I'm a female or I'm a woman composer. It just was, I still was just doing something that nobody else was doing. So it just, you know, I could have been 80 years old or a lesbian or a Black woman or anything. And it wouldn't have mattered. Also unusual. So, and again, just the kind of serendipity of timing more than anything else. So I'd say that I keep mentioning the word collaborative, but that, you know, that was the basis. The other thing was because of working with in theater where it involved or needed or I wanted it to be creating sounds in a much wider range than Usachevsky or Mario Devrosby would have used in their piece to be presented in a contemporary music concert. I was often using human voices, piano sounds, percussion sounds, sometimes things off sound effects records, bird sounds, and distorting them hugely. And so I developed techniques in the studio, just like technical with equipment we had that were also different from what most people, I had to develop certain techniques to do what I wanted to do. And so me within myself, that was a huge satisfaction because in the studio I was doing things that I knew nobody else was doing, nor would want to or need to or anything else, but it was just my own thing.
I was thinking that often in the history of electronic music, we think about a kind of translation or process of transfer between what's produced in the studio and then what's presented in the concert hall or on an album. And here we're talking about a completely different sort of creative translation where you're immersing yourself in the world of Shakespearean poetics and drama other theater collaborations, sometimes outdoors, sometimes in large theaters, and the fact that your identity within the studio and within the institutions of classical music was a marginalized identity is ironically what made it so that you needed to reach out to find a different realm for collaboration and experimentation outside of the concert hall. And then you found this extraordinary freedom of collaboration that you may not have found otherwise if you had been, say, a new Sachevsky or a Babbitt.
Yeah, good point. And I wouldn't have, I wouldn't have, just to your last point, I wouldn't have, because it was such a, the way you're putting it makes me think, it was such a narrow series of routes, or just was one route. I mean, when I was teaching my students, they, after they got their doctorate, they were either going to go, I couldn't make any money as a composer, that was a given, but they would go a teaching route, or some of them actually went and found a different kind of entry, at least to make a living in a sound studio. But they're, if they were going to stay and just be the kind of composer that they studied to be at the Electronic Music Center, that lane was narrow too, because by the late 60s and 70s, it was a great era in contemporary music, because there was a lot of contemporary music groups and a lot of chances for performance of new compositions. And it, but it still, in my mind, was a narrow route that didn't, it just didn't appeal to me. And I ended up only writing three full electronic compositions, and two of them, the last one took me 3 years, and I somehow knew it was my last piece.
What advice would you have for young people pursuing a career in the arts today, especially if they worry they don't fit in for reasons of identity or background?
Well, first of all, go get something that pays. Go be a waitress. Go be like everybody else did back then. That's a big question. And some of it applied way back then too. It's just like you come out of your institution of learning. You have, even if you don't have a degree, you've studied certain things. And if you came from a collaborative institution where I got spoiled at Bennington, average of 2 music majors a year and 12 full-time faculty in music. So I wasn't, you know, it wasn't even classes. It was studying one-on-one with all kinds of music faculty. So I'm a huge anomaly. But if a person coming out of some kind of learning now is probably not going to just be able to fit into some perhaps pictured slot or milieu, unless somebody, a cohort or somebody, has given you an idea of where there's an open door. But that's so much harder now, because some people are finding their doors on the internet, and sometimes just by default, it's just such a different world. So as far as advice, I mean, one thing would be, try not to have expectations. Instead of expectations, maybe have wishes or ideas. If you happen to be imbued with a sense of curiosity, that takes you a long ways, because you might see something on the internet or go to a performance having nothing to do with what you've studied or are interested in, and it might spark an idea that you're curious enough to learn more about, like how did that performer do that or that whatever, and how can I wonder if I can talk to that performer. So I think the networking is more difficult these days, but it's hard to just enter an entity that's a whole entity. I think you have to find, you know, you're not going to find very rarely an open door. So maybe a door, there's a door and you just notice I think it's open a crack. So you go look in the crack and, you know, maybe it's a bunch of waiters and waitresses as you shut the door. Or maybe there's the door is closed, but there's interesting sounds or something coming from the door. So you put your hand on the knob of the door and decide when you want to open it. So I think it's, if you, in addition to being imbued with curiosity, if you happen to be imbued with just confidence in yourself somehow, that helps a lot. I never myself was ambitious, the many things that word means. Some people make progress because they are ambitious. They make sure they go meet a certain person. If you're built like me, that's not the approach you're able to take.
But you still found that crack in the door.
Yeah, I found, well, I mean, it was
or the doorknob.
it was easier than that for me because once I was an intern at the Electronic Music Center, there were so many open doors, I didn't know which to go through first. Mm-hmm. So that just isn't, that's such an anomaly, and probably more so these days. The world is a much more complicated place. Mm-hmm. There's, how easy is it, do you think, that rhetorical question, to land in something that's a whole new field with nobody having even begun to experiment in it?
And yet when those fields do arise, it can provide the opportunity for all kinds of new collaborative possibilities and career trajectories.
And sometimes it's just a lot, I think, just happens with networking with individual people. I mean, mm-hmm. there's more than once where I met somebody in music at a cocktail party and we struck up a conversation. Oh, you're doing that? Oh, you know, can you play me that? Just kind of by default, you're in a place, you strike up a conversation. And sometimes, like Henry Brandt, go talk to Uzi Chesky. I mean, if Henry Brandt hadn't been there, that's not ever where I would have, if it hadn't been for Henry Brandt, I wouldn't even have a career in music. It's just those, you know, if this, if that. So it's really just following different tracks and believing in yourself.
Well, thank you, Pearl Smiley, for sharing from your experience and work with us today. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you and hear your narratives and to learn about your career.
Unsung Stories, Women at Columbia's Computer Music Center is a three-pronged event, a podcast series, a symposium, and a concert that focuses on the history of composers of marginalized identities, including women composers of color, who have undertaken significant creative work in electronic and computer music. The project's objectives are to spotlight the little-known work of many of the women who studied and worked at the CMC since 1951, to explore collectively how institutional networks and intersections of race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and other identifications impacted and continue to impact the daily work and visibility of women composers, and to examine how systemic racism, as it intersects with gender and sexuality, can be combated in the field of electronic music, one that is still largely dominated by white men. For more information, please visit unsungstoriescmc.com. This podcast was produced by Zasha DeCastri, Eli Hassama, and Paola Cosermelli Messina, with editing by David Adamsic. Our theme song was composed by DMR. You can learn more about her music and work at dmr.land. This project is made possible by the generous support of a public outreach grant from the Center for Science and Society at Columbia University.